whatever is comfortable for you to help support and sustain Radio WBAI. Our pledge line is always open, and the number is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. It's 9 o'clock in New York, and coming up next over WBAI is Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg.
Absolutely, gotta get it. We're crying out for justice. There cannot be any peace without justice. I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and this is Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people, for another world is possible, and we are the ones to make it so. Today, Illmatic Consequences. All praise to Nas the rapper, whose first hit album, Illmatic, is still perceived of as a work of genius. And so in the spirit of rap Illmatic Consequences, we are clapping back. We are clapping back to opponents of critical race theory with the authors of that newly released book, a compilation of essays with Dr. Walter Grayson and Danyon Darrell Jerry. And I have to say that Dr. Walter Grayson is professor and chair of the Department of History at McAllister College and the preeminent historian of Afrofuturism. Oh, you'll find out a lot more about that. And Danyon Darrell Jerry, well, he's a writer. He's a griot. He's a storyteller. He teaches at the University of Memphis, and we are using their just-released book, Illmatic Consequences, the Clapback to Opponents of Critical Race Theory, which uses the hip-hop masterpiece Illmatic by Nas as a vehicle to identify, explore, and show us how to beat back. I was going to say beat back the Bakke attack, the slogan that first took me to protest the Supreme Court, Alan Bakke's throwback to then affirmative action, but we're going to beat back the race-based injustice in all of its guises. And I want to thank them both for being with us. But before we even begin with our esteemed guests, I want to play I want to go to Richmond, Virginia, and I want to bring the issue to the fore with a news clip. So let's hear that.
The Lexington-Richland 5 school board has heard both sides of an argument now surrounding a book about racism used for a high school lesson. Our Peyton Lewis has more on the school board's discussion about their policies on controversial topics in the classroom.
We cannot become critical thinkers without being uncomfortable in some way. If students can't learn these things in a safe space like school, how are they, we, meant to make good decisions and think critically.
A sea of blue showed up to the Lexington Richland 5 school board meeting Monday. This flood of support comes from a school lesson that happened back in February. Teacher Mary Wood at Chapin High School decided to use the book Between the World and Me after getting it approved by her leadership. The book explores experiences with racism with firsthand accounts. A student in the class voiced that the book made them feel, quote, guilty for being white. The lesson was stopped by the school board, and now the question for the policy of academic freedom is in question. District Superintendent Dr. Akil Ross took a moment during his meeting report to discuss the policy.
So in my opinion, the feelings and the thoughts of the adults are very important to me, Superintendent. But what matters most to me is that my students have the ability to hear 6 and 7 different opinions on one topic and come up with their own thesis, supported with evidence, and come up with an independent conclusion.
The citizens who showed up wearing blue on Monday did so to present the opposing point of view from what the board heard at its last meeting.
We now know that there have been teachings in a school here in this district of systemic racism. There have been assignments given on systemic racism. These topics are very uncomfortable and inappropriate.
And the author of the book in question came to the meeting and sat next to the teacher in question to show his support for her. People like Josh Gray say he showed up to support teachers.
It's reached a point, I think, where many of us feel, based on the reaction to some other, I would say, rather extreme political groups, that now it's time to make a counterstatement of support for the teachers in the schools.
But people like Janet Howell disagree with the book being taught.
They called us a loud minority that's speaking out against it. But I have to say that we are a loud majority.
The board held a discussion after public comment, but no votes were taken. Reporting in Irmo, Peyton Lewis, News 19, WLTX.
And we're being told the next board meeting will be August 7th at the district office. No word on if the board will revisit this topic.
And the author in question who came to support the teacher who had given the lesson from the book Between the World and Me was none other than the great and acclaimed internationally Ta-Nehisi Coates. Now, I want to just add one more thought or news clip, if you will. Just Wednesday, the Florida State Board of Education approved new yet further new rules for how Black history will be taught in public schools that critics are decrying as a step backward. Now check this out. The updated standard, they say that students should learn that enslaved people, quote, developed skills that were beneficial, that could be applied for their personal benefit. That needed to be taught. It was a productive period. And that in teaching about mob violence against Black residents, instructors should note, quote, acts of violence perpetrated against and by African Americans. So with that, I want to welcome Dr. Walter Grayson, Damian Darrell, Jerry, our storytellers, our educators, and to do what? To educate, agitate, and organize us around their project that claps back against opponents of critical race theory. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
So given that introduction, what take us from there and what you think that means to this project? And it's really a project as much as a book that you have engaged your co-authorship on critical race theory and clapping back, I would suggest punching back, really, but that's my anger against the opponents of critical race theory.
So thank you so much for letting us join the conversation with you today. That's exactly what we had in mind as we've worked through this project over the last couple of years, is that so much coverage has gone to Ron DeSantis or Glenn Youngkin and their minions who are trying to silence educators and silence families who really demand the highest standard of quality education at all levels. And so in structuring Illmatic Consequences, we put together first an accurate definition of critical race theory and scholarly discussions of its importance. But then in the middle section, the second section, we go through and explain this backlash, this attempt to go from a white supremacist standpoint and silence people who hope to create justice for everyone. And so that second section is where we understand how we clap back, how we stand up, much like Coates had done in Virginia, much as a number of educators are doing in Florida. But we must stand up together as the vocal majority in this country to resist people who take knowledge off the table. And then we close the section with the consequences. The book really focuses on how do we move forward? How do we actually build a just and inclusive society for all people in the United States and indeed around the world? So that's my synopsis. But I definitely like wanted to share, because the heart of the work is what Danian does, is this idea of storytelling. And so I wanted to pass the mic and definitely let him explain the power of the work that he brings to the book.
Thank you, Walter. And I would like to start by noting what I would like to refer to as the unfortunate timeliness of this book. When we first began working on this project, like over 2 years ago, critical race theory had already become a talking point. And when I say critical race theory, I put that into quotations, right? Because it's about the misappropriation of the term. But the misappropriation of critical race theory had already become a talking point. Governor Youngkin had just been elected. And over time, we have seen, right? We have seen the pushback against Black progressiveness grow to the point where we are now. What we are talking about is the difference between a democratic republic and a fascist nation, right? Where, and one of the key signatures of a fascist nation is the curation of education, right? The education being presented from the perspective of the people in power, who don't want to see other people rise up and assume any amount of power at all. So as far as storytelling, what we also do is we sort of like bring this existentialist piece into the book, whereas we show the lives of Black people and we show the oppression of Black people through their stories. Right. We show how classrooms are being overran by conservatives, right, through the testimony of the teachers in those classrooms who are doing their best to maintain the integrity of their lessons and who are doing their best to protect the students under their charge.
I do want to bring in one other element before we continue to understand what this project is and delve more into how we are to understand critical race theory. And I must say, hell yeah, we're woke and ain't gonna put us back to sleep. So I'm claiming, I'm expropriating that term and using it as the right so often does with our terms. But I want to really understand the issue of, because there's a process here as well as substance that is most interesting, and that is the conceptualization around or the realization of Afrofuturism and also using the book Illmatic Consequences as the title, Illmatic, going back to the album that was done, I think it was in 1994, by Nas, which I became very familiar with because I do a lot of work in the housing project, the largest housing project in the country, which is Queensbridge, which is where Nas was from. So bring that element of because the work is like tracks on a rap album. There's a language and a beat and a rhythm here that is most important to convey as well. So who wants to take us into that discussion so we can understand the substance and the process of the creation of this critical race theory book, Ilmatic Consequences, that clap back to opponents of critical race theory?
Okay, well, I think I can start it off. I think first, I would like to say that I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the point that Derrick Bell, who was considered to be the grandfather, one of the progenitors of critical race theory, one of the forefathers of it, was a science fiction writer. His story, Slave Traders, is directly influenced by his work as a civil rights attorney. Slave Traders is basically about, it starts off set in the United States. I'm sorry, Space Traders. The story Space Traders, basically, it starts off in the United States, and the premise is aliens come and they say, okay, we have the answers to all of your problems. Like, we can end disease, we can end hunger, we can end crime, we can end everything. All you have to do is turn over all of your Black citizens to us. Right. And there was a criteria. It was almost like a paper bag test. Right. There was a certain pigmentation, and people who were darker than that certain standard, those are the people who were turned over to the aliens. And one of the main characters in the book works for the government. And he had to come to the realization that even though he had done, he had contributed greatly, right, to the government, he had contributed greatly to the United States, that the United States was not going to appeal for him. In fact, they instituted laws and they used the military to gather everyone up to trade them to the aliens, right? And so I think that's where I want to start it. The fact that Derrick Bell himself wrote science fiction and he practiced law, and the two played off of each other. Also, when I think of Afrofuturism, when I think of hip hop, when I think of critical race theory, I think about Black people thinking outside of the box, Black people being forced through oppression and situations of great distress in order to being forced to think creatively in order to solve their problems. And those situations have given us some of the greatest academics, some of the greatest minds in the world. Also, when we think about Ilmatic laid out these stories that describe what was going on pretty much in every urban community in the United States, really, right, all over the world.
And that was the rap album by Nas that, yes. Actually, I think it was his first one that became, yes, critically acclaimed and now is an icon in many ways. Nas, yes, for those who may not know, again, is a rapper who grew up in Queensbridge housing in New York. And his experiences and existence was conveyed most graphically and most exactly in that initial album, Ilmatic. Just wanted to give that for some of the generation that may not have been thoroughly aware.
Yes, yes. Nas was only, in fact, when Nas wrote the album, he was only like 16 years old. So he actually wrote it many of those songs before it even came out. And it's interesting that you brought up Queensbridge. Here, I live in Memphis, Tennessee. I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, and this is where I reside. The first housing projects in Memphis, Tennessee, Foots Homes. Before it was Foots Homes, it was a prosperous middle-class Black community headed up by the progenitor of our city, Robert Church. After Robert Church passed, his house was burned down and this whole neighborhood was bulldozed under the guise of, it was called slum removal. Slum removal was paid for by the New Deal, right? So they burned Robert Church's house down. And Robert Church, his house was a symbol of Black power in Memphis. He saved Memphis not long after, like, the yellow fever epidemic of, like, the late 1800s. He bought up all this land. And after the city pretty much, half the city had left, the city had lost its charter. Robert Church buys up all this land. He brings the city back to prominence. But over time, he came into conflict with reactionary and also with racist powers in Memphis, headed under a man named Mayor Crump. He was referred to in Memphis as Boss Crump. So when Robert Church's house was burned down, that was a sign of Black political power being destroyed in Memphis. Also, the Victorian houses that were in that neighborhood were bulldozed. And you had these high-rise these complexes placed over that. The homeowners were displaced, and then they were given the option to move back into the projects and rent the apartments, to rent the houses, well, the apartments.
Outstanding. And appreciate the sharing of the background. The piece on Memphis reflects so much of what goes into the heart of Illmatic Consequences as a text, is that that storytelling, it's not just about Nas and the 1994 Illmatic album, although this is a great example that we use. Telling our stories, preserving our voices, letting our families speak, often from old age, but also for young people, preserving our youth voices and making sure that they last and grow and transform our world. That's the core tool that Danian is spelling out for y'all right there. For me, from Jump, Derek Bell's piece as a civil rights attorney being coupled with his civic and science fiction writing in the Space Traders story, that piece has changed and reflects over two centuries of Black innovation in this country. So you can go back to Richard Allen in Philadelphia and resisting segregation of Black churches and being able to build up the legacy of Black institutions that actually made abolitionism possible in the antebellum period. That kind of work, the linkage of claiming human rights, requires an Afrofuturist orientation to imagine a world that doesn't yet exist. And so those two pieces go hand in hand from the very jump, and starting to get people to understand this is not simply a rational critical thinking process. It must also be a creative production process. It must be a way that we generate new art, new language, new vision that actually inspires people to move. And that is the piece that drives the white backlash, is that they understand that it's not just people of African descent that are coming together and realizing and practicing these tools. In the wake of the George Floyd killing, and I'm doing the work out here in Minneapolis, St. Paul right now to preserve those stories and to build institutions around that moment. That moment with George Floyd changed how white people, how Latinos, how Asian people saw the capacity to be democratic citizens, to be leaders in their own lives. That's what drove the backlash. That's what continues to animate these efforts by politicians across the country to silence and disempower people. They can't govern a country where everyone feels they have the power to stand up and protect themselves. And that's the most dangerous piece of what we do in the book, is that last piece. It's not just the energy. It's not just the emotion to stand up. It's how do you focus it? How do you take the step that Ta-Nehisi Coates took last week and stepped into sitting beside a teacher silently? He could have flipped that entire meeting on its head with two sentences. He wouldn't have had to speak for 30 seconds and he would have changed the entire tone of that meeting. But his silence, his standing behind the people who had organized, is maybe the most powerful gesture. He's able to take the tool and discern where does he speak, where does he support, how does he decide in what situation is the best move to kind of advance what we can do right now. How do we rebuild places like Memphis in the way that we see in Danian's story? How do we actually expand, not just on the National Museum in D.C., but on the Schomburg Center in Harlem? How do we expand on the infrastructure that's here in the Midwest, in Chicago and Minneapolis and St. Louis? These are the challenges that we have for the next decade. And so taking this work from being both critical, the way Derrick Bell was, and creative, and then using all of those tools right now to protect our lives and to build a better society for everyone.
And I must add that the minute you say Derrick Bell, I recall that the last time I was with Derrick Bell, who had passed away, was when there was mass arrests, waves of arrests by different categories and groups and occupations of people in response to the murder, the dozens and dozens of shots that were fired by the police into the body of Amadou Diallo. And it was a very creative series of protests where different groups of people each day showed up to express their horror and efforts towards rectification of the continuing brutalization of Black citizenry by the police. And so he was one of the people with whom we were arrested. And this was Professor Derrick Bell, who was also a mentor of mine. I was a law student at the time, who was one of the, and must be said, one of the most brilliant legal theoreticians, understanders of the law, strong in his understanding of the imperative to meld and realize the role that white supremacy, that settler colonialism, that racism played in shaping the law and interacting with it, and how that was translated into practice and policies that affected the communities of African ancestry. And so all praise to Derrick Bell, again, one of the great, great theoreticians and teachers of law ever, and his proteges then, Patricia Williams, Kimberly Crenshaw came later, which takes us to, and maybe we need to just hone in a little bit more on the issue of critical race theory, which is, I said, I understand, really shows the falsities behind the proclamation that we were living in a democratic state, an egalitarian state, and that this is how the law kind of, that's the foundation that it was built on. And yet, Derrick Bell taught us so well, and you should still go back and read his Voices at the Bottom of the Well, among his other books. But he devised a methodology for understanding our system of jurisprudence for law students to grapple with how racism infected and affected the law and the policies and practices that flowed from this in both the private market and state governance. Witness the Dred Scott decision. So maybe you can talk a bit more, and then we can continue to tell the stories and actually get some readings from the book on the understanding of critical race theory and why this erasure, which is part of it, is becoming so prominent at this particular point in time. And why don't Well, which one of you wants to start us off? And again, we're speaking with Dr. Walter Grayson and the great, profound griot storyteller, Damian Darrell Jerry.
Go ahead, Danny.
Okay. For me, and when critical race theory as a discipline is a law discipline, and the basics of it is that there is inherent racism in the law. Inherent racism from the Constitution on up. Inherent racism in not only the law as it exists on paper, but the law as in terms of the bodies, the parts of the government that write the laws and create the laws. Also, the fact that since the law itself has segments that are inherently racist, this racism stretches out from the law to pretty much every facet of our society. Because when we think about law, you have to think about public policy. There's this thing where lawyers like Derrick Bell, Kimberly Crenshaw, they were fighting for civil rights in the courtrooms. And what they were seeing was a disparity, right, between, say, the Civil Rights Bill and the actual execution and the application of the bill. So that's where critical race theory comes in as a discipline. Also, just the notion that there is a part of Blackness that is defined by its interaction with the law.
Absolutely. And so just to build on that a little bit, the pieces that are pioneered by civil rights attorneys, again, stretch back to the work of the NAACP and Charles Hamilton Houston. They basically are laying out the ways that you get the Civil Rights Act of 1964, of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968 adopted. It is an approach to understanding the law as a living and evolving document. And I emphasize that to start because, again, the backlash that follows this is the idea of massive resistance coming out of the Brown decision in 54 and 55, that there must be an entire operationalizing of the white state, the racially fascist state across the South, but really nationwide, to resist the implementation of civil rights law. And this is what drives Bell to recognize this distinction between the principles in the law or in the amendments of the Constitution and the actual enforcement and accomplishment of the material advancements that would come from those laws without white resistance. And so there's massive resistance from white authorities, and we can think of Bull Connor, we can think of George Wallace. But by the time we get to 1968, and we are really looking at the presidencies of Richard Nixon, there is an attempt to then flip this and to advance an idea of colorblindness. And we have seen this now embraced by the Supreme Court just a couple weeks ago, is that if we can eliminate the ways that we see racial disparities, we can actually maintain injustice. But there will be no way to then critique it. That is an explicit attempt to undermine the work that Bell and Crenshaw and all critical race theorists have advanced, is that without the data, without the social scientific analysis, there is no Brown decision. There is no federal civil rights law. This whole process begins to move us in a way that literally makes us incapable of acquiring the knowledge to then push for a different world, a world where everyone has the rights that they deserve. That piece then gets entrenched under the Rehnquist Court. And so the transition with Nixon appointing conservative justices has now taken the form of originalism. And this is what is animating John Roberts. It's this way of approaching the text of the Constitution and federal law that basically negates anything that comes in the 20th century. This is what is at the heart of Clarence Thomas's approach when he tries to negate the Roe decision, is that he wants us to come to a place where if there is no grounding in the law back into the 18th century, and for Samuel Alito, sometimes even the 17th or the 16th century prior to the United States existence, all of that is designed to negate the claims for justice, the claims for equality, the promise of the Declaration of Independence, that in fact our rights are inalienable, that we have a right to life, a right to liberty, a right to pursue happiness. These things are all being negated by the Supreme Court under the tools that are responding to Derrick Bell and critical race theory. And that's why we need to be very clear as we walk through the precedents, as we walk through and understand the history of the jurisprudence. We must move forward really not for the next decade or the next two decades. It's going to require a century of work to return to the foundations that we've inherited from Thurgood Marshall, that we have seen the court try to undermine and turn a blind eye towards. So we must reject colorblindness. We must reject textual originalism in the law. These are the tools that prevent us from actually affirming our humanity, our common dignity, and building a just and democratic society.
And I want to give us, as I said, this was a discussion about the substance and the process, really, of ilmatic consequences, the clapback to opponents of critical race theory, the book by Dr. Walter Grayson, Professor Danyon Darnell, Jerry. It is a marvelous, accessible read, and the essays are such that I really feel that I was immersed in a rap rhythm. And I want to just say something that hit me the other day about using the process of rap. We were doing a tribute to the great Mutulu Shakur, prisoner of war, political prisoner, who passed recently. And one of the things that was being lifted up was what an incredible organizer he was. He was an organizer of his people in the communities in Harlem and the Bronx before he was incarcerated and continued to be behind the walls. And one of the things that was said about why it was so effective organizing the incredible potential of people that is behind the walls that has been unrealized is because he spoke in the language of rap, which was a methodology and a rhythm that was part of it, was a language of youth. And youth now approaching middle age as well. And he understood that. And he also used that as a way, even from behind the walls, to try to bring together, through his stepson, Tupac Shakur, the gang communities to really understand their own, again, potential and to respond in a productive way to the oppression that they had and become leaders in their own communities. So the rhythm of rap as a language is very much part of this book. And with that, and you can say it so much better than I can, and if you do want to say it, please do. And if you would be kind enough to pick a passage to give our listeners a sense that you really need to get this book and read it more fully and comprehensively, Ilmatic Consequences, the Clapback to Opponents to Critical Race Theory. Which one of you wants to begin with a passage? And I think both of you are going to read one, but I'll let you structure the rhythm.
You know, I defer to my poet, storyteller colleague. He got the rhythm and the power for it. Go for that, man.
Okay, first, before I read, there are so many wonderful essays. This book rests on the shoulders of so many great minds. It's hard to pick one, but I am, because I'm going to try. And I'm going to read from Michael A. Gonzalez's and his contribution, Black Noise, Whitewash, because I feel that there's a convergence here of culture, there's a convergence of law, and also education. And this story basically, well, his essay is about Black music and the roots of rock and roll, and how the roots of rock and roll being in the blues and how that has sort of been erased. And not only erased from cultural circles, but educational circles, which is the bigger problem. Right? So many of us as Black folks don't know our histories. And I was one of them. Still, there were so many others on both sides of the color line, who didn't know or recognize the truth about Whole Lotta Love. And before I go forward, this is basically about Michael A. Gonzalez and his relationship with Led Zeppelin. He loves Led Zeppelin, but he was troubled to find out how a lot of the music that he loved by Led Zeppelin was taken from blues artists without their permission. All right. Still, there were so many others on both sides of the color line who don't know or recognize the truth about Led Zeppelin's Whole Lotta Love being who didn't know or recognize, I'm sorry, the truth about Whole Lotta Love being swiped from You Need Love, written by Willie Dixon and performed by Muddy Waters. Blind Lemon Jefferson's track, Jesus, Make Up My Dying Bed, will later be transformed into the 11-minute anthem, In My Time of Dying, and Howlin' Wolf's piano drive, How Many More Years, became How Many More Times. Having grown as a child of the Elvis's King propaganda machine and lots of other misinformation concerning rock history, I didn't know any better. Like many others, I thought of Jimi Hendrix as the lone Black rock star, and though the Thin Lizzy lead singer, songwriter, Phil Lynott, was obviously of color, it was never mentioned. I felt a sense of cultural shame that I hadn't been schooled on the subject before. Of course, one wouldn't expect to learn these things in school, where Black history usually consists of slavery, George Washington Carver, and Martin Luther King Jr. But still, I would have thought that someone in my family, especially my music-loving audiophile Uncle Carl, might have enlightened me. It is for this very reason that in 1985, Living Color's lead guitarist Vernon Reid, along with cultural writer Greg Tate, founded the Black Rock Coalition, an organization designed to, among other things, educate people on the roots of these rhythms. The members of the Black Rock Coalition included musicians, writers, and visual artists, as well as more business-minded folks who were unafraid to do their thing. Many people started this music, and I take umbrage that I have to explain that, Reid said in a later interview. The more I learned about Led Zeppelin's blues roots, the more it annoyed me that they had brazenly appropriated the music and claimed it as their own, while the group's members had no problem paying lip service to the blues men and women who inspired them. When it came to songwriting credits and royalties, it was a completely different story. As author Eric Davis documented in his 2005 book, 33 and one-third on Led Zeppelin IV, singer-lyricist Plant honestly seemed to believe that these songs in turn emerged from some collective well of folk memory that welcomed all comers. It was this sort of piracy that would be ultimately costly, as they later faced lawsuits from Willie Dixon and others. While it could be argued that Led Zeppelin's cultural thievery brought recognition to otherwise obscure men, I'm sure they would have preferred to get a few dollars instead. I couldn't help but equate their actions to white men sailing to the New World and snatching land and resources from the natives. But instead of bullets, Zeppelin used lawyers. In the end, did it matter? The white guys would be the bigger stars, while the Black originators would remain footnotes.
Amen.
Heavy.
So for my piece, I'm going to start with the intro, and I can't, I'm better frankly, reading my own stuff. You know, hopefully as we do more of these, I'll get better at reading some of the other folk. But first time out, I'm going to start from the intro, my intro that I put together, and then wrap up with something towards the end. Hip hop is at its roots the music of the dispossessed. With no instruments, no electricity, no access to authority, street poets crafted lyrics and stories from their imaginations and the surrounding environment to inspire one another. As a practice, hip-hop culture transformed educational institutions, corporate industries, and spiritual life worldwide. It verbalized the instrumental improvisation that jazz offered to the world. By showcasing dynamic wordplay and unleashing unprecedented forms of sonic force, hip-hop showed how the powerless can reshape every aspect of daily life. The simple aesthetic of adaptation and agility bridged hundreds of cultures, transcending language itself. The art could be harmonic or dissonant. It could accelerate or decelerate from one moment to the next. Hip-hop made the immediate moment the most valuable commodity in human existence. It offered an escape from industrial and digital routines. Nothing is more important in a world gone mad with violence, where everyone struggles to develop some sense of meaning. Then from the end, when Nas crafted the lyric, "Afraid not of none of you cowards, but of my own strength," he captured a psychological advantage that stretched back to the legends of Staggerly and John Henry, defiant Africans whose strength overcame whatever obstacles they faced. The power of Black folklore kept these legends alive until the reality of African-American excellence met and exceeded the standards set by these heroic men. Paul Robeson transformed every facet of the world's politics and entertainment to make peace the standard of international diplomacy. W.E.B. Du Bois reshaped the entire structure of critical inquiry in the Western world to make true science and knowledge production possible. Ella Fitzgerald and Aretha Franklin made music the fundamental magic of spiritual and emotional intelligence to articulate countless legacies of freedom dreams. Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, and Angela Davis crafted concepts as weapons to dismantle systems of exploitation. Steve Biko, Miriam Makeba, and Nelson Mandela marshaled these weapons to dismantle the remnants of African enslavement and European imperialism. These traditions are the strength that Nas describes. Aimé Césaire and Frantz Fanon debated the power of this force as negritude. It is the ability to face violence, terrorism, and oppression with a resilience that defies belief. The strength of blues, jazz, hip-hop, and the entire range of the Black speculative arts movement exceeds anything a conservative pundit and his corporate media sponsors might design. Everyone who understands critical race theory knows that the reactionary racists are the cowards. And the only real barrier to our access as African revolutionaries is our strength, is our ignorance of the strength we carry in our families and communities. Let these chapters offer a step forward in understanding our power and abolishing our fears.
Well, in exuberance, as it would be said, teach, 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 educate, agitate, and organize. Damian Darrell Jerry, Professor Dr. Grayson. Wow. And that's just a sample and sampling, if you will, of this larger kind of rap, hip hop rhythm that is there throughout the book, and it does just that. It educates, agitates, and organizes. And I thank you for those wonderful readings and the storytelling in the book. It just grabs you in and it enriches you with every track that is in there. I want to ask, though, politically, the issue of erasure. Certainly, I see it most dramatically in the settler colonial state of Israel, where they are trying to eradicate, cleanse from the land, and cleanse the land, really, of the nation of Palestine and the Palestinian people and culture, all things that are Palestine. So it would seem to me, and I wonder if you agree, and we are to understand that the onslaught now of the attack of critical race theory rather than just an outright attack on quote unquote Black Lives Matter per se, is about an effort to erase education, history on earth, the dignity that comes with the knowledge of one's true past and the potential there. Is that what we're, why the fascist state and frankly liberals who are imbued with white skin privilege, is that what they're also talking about and doing, and why the resistance to critical race theory or any teaching of a black history as told by the self-determination, the work, the blood, sweat, and tears of people of African ancestry? How are we to understand that now?
Oh, so you hit close to home to me. Daniel, can I jump on this real quick?
Of course.
Yeah, man. My second book was titled Suburban Erasure, and it was published in 2013 and did real well. I think the biggest impact was early in social media, like Facebook and Twitter days. It really popularized this phrase and made people pay attention to the way that their lives and experiences were being structurally wiped away by state authority. And ironically, as an academic, as I went through my career, I'll tell you, the publishers didn't want to publish the book. They were like, oh, you know, this isn't what we normally do. This is, we want these works that are talking about, you know, how do we generally bring stories of that celebrate these processes of recreation and transforming the land. And my whole career is dedicated against that like, I was sitting in one elite university and a very senior colleague said to me, "Is like, well, it's really hard to erase the past." And I'm like, do you know anything of indigenous studies? What has happened to the people around this world in the wake of European imperialism, of racial capitalism? Like, those are nothing but stories of erasure. In fact, I've said publicly for many years, scholars erase more history than they ever write. Let me say it again so people really hear it. Scholars erase more history than they ever write. Anything that comes through the publishing industrial complex, that comes through, and that's a point to celebrate Universal Right Publications, who we worked with here. This is a Black woman-owned press that's pioneered a relationship to invert these systems of exploitation. But I come from a place that has literally been wiped off the land. My older cousin, who I grew up with, had mental disabilities, and I basically, from age 4, had to care for him, make his meals, help wash, make sure every day was right. And so I got to see the scars on his back from where he was beat in the fields. My man was working at age 5 in the 1930s and didn't get to stop until the 1960s. And the people who were trapped in the same situation were my neighbors. And now the place that I lived is completely overrun by Donald Trump supporters. Where in 2016, I'm going to vote, and a dude who had just moved there from Staten Island is standing behind me online and being like, I don't believe he lives here. He wants to try and censor and deny my right to vote based off of his misperception that he has a legitimate claim to that land. All across this country, people are being gentrified, displaced, and all of that is in service to erasing the voices that is now being made explicit by these politicians as they try to run for president, they run for governor, they try to like abuse and intimidate people in these school board meetings. And I'm not going to have it. Like that is exactly why I participate in the work, why we put this book together. We stand up for our spaces and our times and our lives to say we have as legitimate a claim as anyone, in fact, a more legitimate claim to make this country, to make this world the best place it can be. And so you talk to me about this process of what's happening in Israel or what's happening in Iran or what's happening in Russia and Ukraine. All of these processes are rooted in a poison that stretches back hundreds, if not thousands of years. And it's what we've done in this book that actually gives us the tools to do something better, to stand up for the Black liberation tradition, for the Black freedom struggle, and show the way that humanity can reach its highest potential. So I'm going to stop because I will rant. I will definitely rant.
You are not ranting. You are clapping back. And just to say that Dr. Grayson's also done a digital humanities project, the Wakanda syllabus, and all of this is, and many other things, both of our comrades here. All of this is, and erasure is, make no doubt about it, are about racial violence. There is nothing neutral. There is nothing democratic. There is nothing humanitarian. It is an act of racial violence to erase the history, the self-determination, the storytelling of people who have been and continue to be absolutely oppressed. And the storytelling in this book, the use of everyday narrative to investigate history as a sociological lens, is so important. I must insist that you really put this on your list. Don't get your information solely by social media. Don't forget your books. Ilmatic Consequences, The Clapboard to Opponents of Critical Race Theory. And it's so important. It's so pointed and poignant. Why do you think that white racism is trying to eradicate it, and under the guise of critical race theory somehow being discomforting for folks? Well, people who have privilege from oppression should feel discomforted. Not to internalize and destroy their psyche, but to spur them on to acts of new generosity and consideration and inclusion. And we just have too little time, just minutes left. And with that, I want to give the, I wouldn't say the exact final word, but maybe the final concluding issue to Damian. What riffing off of what your colleague, your comrade has said, do you want to convey to us about the book? Do you want to read another passage, or do you want to just let it hang out just like Dr. Grayson so appropriately did?
I want to say one thing to piggyback off what Dr. Grayson just said. When you erase the purpose of erasure, right, is not just to erase a people's culture or to erase their history. It's to erase the people. That's where it leads to. There's a book that I really love called Survival in Auschwitz by Primo Levi. And it's about his stint through Auschwitz. And he wrote in there, he said that the Nazi soldiers laughed at them. And they told him to his face, they said, we are going to kill all of you. And no one's ever going to know what happened, because none of you are going to be left to tell the story. Right. So that's why erasure is so important. And that's why we have to keep fighting back. We have to keep pushing back. We have to keep clapping back, because the lives of our children, our lives are on the line as a people.
Amen.
Well, we have 30 seconds left for each one of you to take us to punctuate this discussion, although I wish we had hours more. So you're just going to have to come back and give us regular segments. You are great storytellers, activists, and you use culture as a tool for self-determination and self-defense amongst oppressed peoples, and we all must internalize that and learn from it. So 30 seconds apiece. Damian, why don't you continue the flow, and then and we'll take it right up to the line. Dr. Grayson?
Oh, we got Damian, you going to go?
Oh, buy the book. And I want to say thanks to our publisher, Dr. Ayo Sakai, but also Kimberly Crenshaw and all of the women who have contributed to hip hop culture, starting with Sylvia Robinson. Because like when we talk about erasure, definitely, you know, the erasure of Black women and their contributions from the civil rights movement in history. is a big point. Also, shouts out to the editorial director of Illmatic Consequences, Dr. Ronaldo Anderson.
Yes, and I'm going to add Stacey Robinson for the great art.
Stacey Robinson, yes. We'll glorious art.
And, yeah, that's a whole other piece. We need to do a whole other show on Stacey.
We will. How about 20 seconds more?
I got you. So right now we're standing up in a world we need to be in solidarity, whether it's with actors or with writers or any people who are doing this work, who are standing up in our transportation system as truck drivers, airplane pilots. Stand in solidarity for the maximum compensation as well as the maximum time off so that we can enjoy our lives and live them to the fullest. Stand in solidarity.
And clap back to the opponents of critical race